The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by Miku, Baltimore's credit union, and the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development. I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome this hour. We have a lot in store today. We'll be talking with Senator Ben Cardin in just a minute, talking to three experts on Iran, and look at the latest from Twitter and Facebook on Iran and what's going on. And then in the next hour, have a roundtable of city teachers looking at the year past. But right now, let's get you all home safe and turn this over to WEAA Traffic.
Support for WEAA is provided by TNT. The Closer is on tonight at 9, followed by Stephen Botchko's Raising the Bar at 10 on TNT.
Problems on the JFX with the update brought to you by New Centrum Ultra. JFX southbound between the Beltway and the Ruxton Road overpass. A crash there with only the right shoulder squeezing by. Heavy traffic on the Inner Loop Beltway between Charles Street and Providence Road with a crash on Providence Road at Hampton Lane. One on Pulaski Highway at White Marsh Boulevard as well. Baltimore City accidents. Hilton at Monastery, Broadway at Lancaster, and Ponca at 95. In Anne Arundel County, an issue for the BW Parkway northbound before the Beltway. The shoulder is blocked by that crash with other county accidents, Sunrise Beach at 178 and Rockenbach at 175. New Centrum Ultra and New Centrum Silver Ultra multivitamins are scientifically advanced and specifically formulated for men and women. Live complete. I'm Joanna Campbell with Baltimore Area Traffic.
Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. We are talking in the first part of this hour with Senator Ben Cardin, who joins us from Washington, D.C. by his phone, via phone. And Senator Cardin, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Mark, it's always a pleasure being on your show.
Good to have you here. And the lines are open at 410-319-8888, and we'll talk about a couple of things with Senator Cardin today, about both Benjamin Netanyahu's speech and about the election in Iran, both very briefly, and hear his thoughts.
Sure.
So, Ben, talk about what your communique your office sent out first, starting with Iran, which is what we're going to talk about for the rest of the hour.
Well, Iran's a police state. It's a dictatorship. There's no democracy to speak of in the country. The election was not open. It was not fair. And we knew going into this election, it wasn't an opportunity for people to freely run for president. It was very controlled by the supreme leader. And it's now becoming more and more apparent, even under these very difficult circumstances, the election is not being counted fairly. So I guess we're not surprised, but we're disappointed at the failure of the leadership of Iran to respect the will of their people.
Now, one of the things that I think that people are saying in the White House so far is being fairly diplomatic about what they're saying about the Iranian election, in that nobody really knows at this point what happened. I mean, it could in fact be that they stole the election. It could be that they trumped up the number of votes that Ahmadinejad actually got, though he may have won, some say, with rural support. Are they saying he lost the election? We really don't know, though, do we?
But we do know that the election leading up to the election was not a fair and open election. People, all candidates could not run. Only selected groups could run. The press is controlled. There's not an open opportunity to criticize the government. So, no, this election was not a fair election going into the balloting. What happened after the balloting is unclear, but my guess is that it was not counted fairly.
So, Ben, let's talk something about a couple of the issues that I know that you've been deeply involved in. But first, your comment today on President Prime Minister Netanyahu's speech, which I kind of read this afternoon, and listened to a bit of it, but read the whole thing. And some in the press are kind of touting it as a bridge to peace, but I was reading some news from other parts of the world and what their comments were, and just what your take on it is. Let me tell you exactly what I mean. I mean, in that speech, he said they're going to continue to build and expand settlements. In the speech, he said...
No, but he didn't say that. He said that there'd be no new settlements. So that, to me, that is a major statement that they will not construct new settlements. I was over in Israel not long ago and saw some new settlements being started. I think it was a major breakthrough that Israel sincerely wants to negotiate a two-state solution. Now, obviously, some of the comments made during the speech were for the benefit of the Israeli audience and for Israel's position. But that's normal for a leader to make. I was disappointed that the Arab criticism of the speech, because I thought it was a sincere effort to sit down with the Palestinians, as Mr. Netanyahu said, without conditions, to negotiate a peace between the Palestinians and the Israelis that would lead to two independent states living side by side in peace.
That was a step forward. I completely agree. I guess what seemed to trouble some commentators around the country and around the world, and not just in the Arab world, but around the world, period, was that his call for Palestinians to have to recognize a Jewish state of Israel, which is the first time a leader of Israel said that. They've always said recognize the state of Israel. And that's a very different political statement in its overtones and undertones for most people.
Well, I think we would be shocked if Israel did not negotiate for a Jewish state. That is fundamental to the protection not only of Israel's future existence, but as a safe haven for Jews. So I think that should not have surprised anyone to hear Mr. Netanyahu mention that. I think the controversy was one of the negotiating points, and that is how do you compensate Palestinians who were ousted from their homeland? And that's an issue that's going to have to be negotiated, but I think what Mr. Netanyahu is saying, which is the obvious, that it's not going to be an effort for physical returning, but there's always the issue of compensation.
I mean, one more piece of that, and then I want to kind of ask you about some healthcare issues in a moment before you have to go, which is that, I mean, I guess what I was getting to with that is that, I mean, Israel is a Jewish state, and that's clearly part of always kind of the unspoken word in these negotiations, but there's been no Israeli leader who's ever said that in terms of what as a precondition to talk, and that for given that you have in this particular Israeli administration Avigdor Lieberman, who has made it clear he doesn't want Arabs even live in the state of Israel who are born there, who are Palestinian Arabs who live inside the state itself, 20% of the population wanted to have loyalty tests, that for Benjamin Netanyahu to say you have to recognize a Jewish state seems to me to exacerbate the issue rather than kind of ameliorate it and open doors, is what I'm trying to say.
Well, I think you got to put it in context. I think with the clear reading of that comment dealt with whether Arabs would have the right to return, and that's been a very contentious issue.
Yes.
As far as Mr. Lieberman's view, I think that is just outrageous, and I don't think many people in this country or in Israel subscribe to the extreme implementation of his plan. The bottom line is that Israel needs to negotiate an agreement where it can maintain its character as a Jewish state. And that's, I think, what most of the international observers understand. And obviously some of these issues have to be negotiated. And what Mr. Netanyahu said is, let's meet without preconditions. So let's let the parties talk about it. So I thought it was a major breakthrough. Now look, if people want to find reasons not to meet, you can always find reasons not to meet. But Israel is saying, let's sit down, let's talk it over.
So, Senator Cardin, switching gears back to some domestic policy, because you've been deeply involved in addressing the issue of health care for all and trying to create a system where every American has health care. And one of the issues that doesn't seem to be talked about a great deal is the fact that the latest studies coming out show that over 60% of all mortgage foreclosures are a result of people not being able to pay their medical bills.
Yes.
So in all this, and in trying to figure out the huge cost of medical care and the battles over where the cuts are going to be and whether Medicaid and Medicare, some say don't give enough to doctors, and the rising cost of pharmaceuticals and all the rest, what provisions can be made and what discussions are taking place in Congress about not allowing the American people to go broke trying to pay for health care?
Well, Mark, you're right on target with this question. The only option that should not be considered is the status quo in health care reform. and we are taking up health care reform starting this week. I think the framework that President Obama is attempting to get through Congress, and I certainly hope he succeeds, is that everyone will be covered in our system. Everyone will be required to have health insurance. There will be individual responsibility. That means an individual who is not insured today has a responsibility to become insured. There is employer responsibility in that every employer has to help contribute to the cost of health care. And there's governmental responsibility. Government has a responsibility to make sure there's an affordable health plan available to every person in this country. Now, if under that plan, a person today would have to have insurance and would have affordable insurance and then would have the network out there that would provide preventive health care and make the system much more cost-effective than it is today. I would certainly hope that this plan would prevent someone from having to go through bankruptcy because they happened to their child happened to be in a, on the playground and broke her arm, or a person happened to get ill. They shouldn't have to go through bankruptcy because of that.
Can that actually be part of health care reform?
Oh, absolutely. The framework I just talked about is clearly part, is what President Obama wants to see passed by Congress. He wants to make sure that everyone is covered. He wants to make sure that you no longer have the option to say that I don't want health insurance. Everybody has to have health insurance. But on the other side, there will be affordable health care and a delivery system in your community. We want to expand the qualified health centers so that you have community networks in your community where you can get primary health care needs met, where you can get your preventive care, where you can get your dental care, so that there will be affordable care for every person in this country. Now, yes, I think we can do it. I think we can bring down the cost of health care dramatically.
What do you think the role will be, if any, if there should be a role, for a public insurance system, the way President Obama's describing it or the way it's been described by others? I know single-payer has had a hard time getting their voice heard in this discussion about the future of health care. Whether or not we get single-payer or not in America is not what I'm asking, but they've had a hard time getting their voice in this discussion. What about the idea of a public insurance in America?
Well, we have public insurance today. It's called Medicare for our seniors and our disabled population. We also have public insurance for low income. It's called Medicaid. We also have public insurance options for our military. It's called TRICARE. And TRICARE is very popular. Medicare is very popular. And I think with the opponents, how they're misleading, they're saying it's government takeover. It's not government takeover. The Medicare beneficiaries get their health care needs met by private doctors and hospitals. There's been no effort made to privatize, nor will there be an effort made to privatize our health care system. You just get better value when there's a public insurance option. We're talking about adding another 45 million people to the insured rolls of America. Many of these people cannot afford conventional health insurance. They need a reasonably cost plan available to them, and government can provide an alternative. The president does not want someone who currently has health insurance, who's satisfied with it, to have to fear about changing their plans. There's no need to change that. But when you're adding so many more people to the requirements of health insurance, government has a responsibility to make sure there's an affordable product there. Now, private insurance can fully compete. This is trying to keep private insurance somewhat honest in the way that they put together their health care plans, in the way that they market it. And we think having a public option of insurance is extremely important in keeping the cost down.
And I'm curious how you think it ends up keeping the cost down and how we affect cost in America, given how much we really spend in this country, which is an amazing amount of money when compared to the rest of the world and also compared to our overall debt in America.
Well, I can give you just one simple example. Every senior who's enrolled in Medicare, there's a cost to the government. Those who choose private insurance called Medicare Advantage, it costs the government an extra 15 to 20%. So the government plan is much less expensive, the public option, than the private insurance option to the taxpayers of this country. I could give you another example. Medicare Part D, which is prescription drug, is only available through private insurance. There have been more and more studies that said that if there was a public option, the cost would be less. We know that Medicare has a lower administrative cost than private insurance. They don't have to pay for profit. They don't do the advertising that private insurance companies do. They don't have the commissions that they have to pay. So there's that savings. We also know in Medicare there's a better management of care, that you can bundle services so you can manage a person's care. That brings down costs, and private insurance companies have not moved in that direction. So there are certain incentives that can bring down costs by having a private insurance option.
So you introduced an interesting bill in March that is something so far that the President Obama has not signed on to, and we've covered a great deal over the last several years, even going down to Appalachia ourselves to cover the story, which is mountaintop removal.
Oh, right.
And the banning of mountaintop removal as a way to mine coal. And a lot of the senators and congressmen who represent some of those districts, especially in West Virginia, oppose this ban. And So talk about where you think that is and where that is in terms of where President Obama is on this, the White House, and his EPA.
Well, this is one of the most egregious environmental disasters of our time, where mining companies come in and literally remove the top of a mountain in order to get to the coal. They then take what they don't use and put it back down in the valley, polluting the water supplies for the people who live in that region. Literally, people who live in areas where there's mountaintop mining turn on their tap water and they can find it brown. It is very, very devastating to the environment. We have studies that show life expectancy in areas where they've had mountaintop mining is significantly lower than the rest of the population. So this is a practice that's got to end. It's not only destroying the beauty of our outdoors and the loss of mountains, it is environmentally extremely damaging, and it should come to an end. I have filed this bill with Lamar Alexander, a Republican from Tennessee. It's a bipartisan bill. We're going to have a hearing. I chair the Water and Wildlife Subcommittee of the Environment Public Works Committee. We're going to have a hearing next Thursday. We want everybody to have an opportunity to testify. I then hope that we'll take action prohibiting mountaintop mining. It shouldn't be done that way. There are more environmentally friendly ways in order to mine coal. They shouldn't just literally destroy our environment.
And one final thought before we go to break here, and I appreciate you taking the time, is you've been around the Congress and politics for a long time. And if you are a betting man, where would you bet that the end of this health care negotiation in Congress gets us to?
Well, I think we're going to have a major bill enacted and signed by the president. It won't be as aggressive as I would like to see it. I personally would like to see us really bring down the cost of health care and make sure we have preventive care and do the things the president are talking about. But I know how the political process works, and there'll probably be some give and take. But I do believe we'll get a major bill passed and hopefully cover most of the people today who have no health insurance and be able to build on our system so those who are satisfied with their system are able to continue their current health care needs.
And what do you say to the different polls say different things. Some say a majority of Americans, some say a plurality of Americans who support a single-payer system. And that not being part of even most of the major discussions taking place in Congress, whether or not we get there or can get there.
Well, I think there is a discussion about the single payer system. That's why the public insurance option is one of the issues that we want to make sure is on the table. The problem with single payer, it does affect those 85% of Americans today who have private insurance who are basically satisfied with their care. They would lose their current coverage. I think when most people understand that, the degree for support of a single payer is not quite as high as it otherwise would be. There's a lot of frustration among doctors and hospitals, and they say, gee, wouldn't it be nice if we just had the one payer rather than all the different payers? But when you get to the consumer satisfaction level, I think we need to do this in a way that we can maintain support, get something passed in Congress, and really make a difference in our health care delivery.
Ben Cardin, thank you so much. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. Thanks for taking the time with all of us and all of our listeners.
Mark, it's a pleasure to talk to you always. Thanks.
Take care. Senator Ben Cardin has been our guest in the first part of this program. We are now going to turn this program over to a discussion about Iran, what's going on in Iran. We'll be talking with Phyllis Bennis, Shiva Balaghi, and William Kern as soon as we return from this very brief break. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late and Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. We're going to talk about the election in Iran during the rest of this hour. We are joined by Phyllis Bennis, who is Senior Fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, also Fellow at the Transnational Institute in Amsterdam, has been an analyst, writer, and activist around the Middle East for many, many years, been a guest on the show before. Shiva Balagi is a member of the Editorial Committee at the Middle East Report, Vice President of the American Institute of Iranian Studies. Her publication includes Iran, Art, Society, and Revolution, and Saddam Hussein, a Biography, and is currently finishing a book on modern Iranian cultural history. And William Kern is the founder, editor, and publisher of WorldMeet.us. And folks, welcome. Good to have you all with us.
Thanks.
Great to be with you.
So it's been interesting. I've been trying to follow all these Twitters and Facebooks, and a couple of friends of mine, like Roya Hakakian, who's an Iranian author. I've been following her page and all the people kind of writing there. And this has been a pretty interesting turn of events. I'd love to get all your kind of analysis on this, starting with Shiva, then going to Phyllis, and then William. One of the things in some of the reports I've been reading about this election is that there's a real conflict. Some people are arguing that, well, even if Ahmadinejad and others had stole this part of the election, if that is a fact, that he would have won anyway because of the large percentage of rural voters. Then the other side I've heard say that no, that 60% of the voters that put Khamenei in before were women and young people, and that was the largest part of this electorate, and that kind of trumps, for want of a better term, what Ahmadinejad was saying about having rural voters. So I'm curious how you all see that and what you think is reality and ground before we talk about the situation happening right now. Shiva?
Thanks, Mark. Well, first of all, Iran is a little bit unusual in the sense that it's 70% urban, so that even if Ahmadinejad got the majority of the rural vote, it would be difficult for him to have won with such a wide margin. But it seems to me the overarching evidence that he didn't win the election fair and square, even by the Islamic Republic's own system, is the fact that they didn't go about their own regulations in certifying the vote. So within 2 hours of the polls closing, the Ministry of Interior announced that Ahmadinejad had won with 24 million votes. And shortly thereafter, the Supreme Leader congratulated him on his election. So they didn't go by their own regular, normal certification process. If the vote had been fair and squarely won by Ahmadinejad, what do they have to hide?
Phyllis Bennis?
Well, I think that Shiva raises very important questions. I don't think we know all the details. It's pretty clear that people in Iran haven't been given access to all the details of exactly what happened. If there wasn't massive voter fraud, there's a big question of why there's not more transparency. Having said that, I think that what's really important is that the Obama administration has not indicated that the problems with the elections in Iran will lead to a different position than their stated intention of opening new negotiations based on mutual respect, which is the crucial factor. I'm guessing that we're not going to know for a while what the fallout of this election is going to be, either the official side with this so-called investigation that Ayatollah Khamenei has called for, or on the streets. That's clearly not something that we can anticipate yet. But I think that what's important for us here is to make sure that there's no waffling on the part of the Obama administration from their commitment to a different kind of diplomacy than what we've seen over the last 8 years.
Well, let me ask you both this question before we turn to William Kern. I have him jump in on this as well. I wonder what you think about what that diplomacy should be, given what's going on in Iran now. I mean, if in fact, as some say, that the 10 days that the Iran voting body is to rule on the election appeal in 10 days, someone wrote that that's precisely how long it takes him to crush dissent, arrest, and lock up activists before they coronate Ahmadinejad for another term, which is why foreign reporters have been asked to leave, kindly leave. Roya Hakakian wrote on one of her pages today. And I wonder what the two of you think that the American government's response should be to all of this. I mean, some would argue forcefully, saying no, this election was a fraud, this kind of saying no. They've got to play the kind of more neutral diplomatic game if, in fact, negotiations are going to have go on with Iran. So starting with Phyllis Bennett's going to Shiva, and this time we will bring William in. What's your thoughts are on that?
Well, I think that the question for the U.S. government is the policy of the U.S. government, which has been such a dangerous one in the past that has really risked putting the entire region into another war. I think that what we know is that, for example, some of the key questions that are of concern to the U.S. government, including Iran's nuclear power program, is not under the control of the president, whether it's Ahmadinejad or Mousavi or anybody else. It's under the control of the Ayatollah Khamenei, who remains in power. So the question is how to open negotiations at a point once there's stability. Obviously, at a moment of crisis like this, there's not going to be any serious negotiations, any more than there would have been in after the 2000 election with the Gore-Bush debate, when it wasn't clear for days who was going to be president. And I don't think it would have been particularly useful at that time if Iran or any other country had come out and said, well, we recognize that George Bush didn't really win this election and we're not going to recognize his presidency. We might have cheered it on that level, but it would not have been very helpful diplomatically anywhere in the world. And I think the U.S. finds itself in that same position right now.
Shiva Balagi, how do you see that?
Well, I think it's very complicated, as Phyllis is indicating, because many of us who have been, you know, really hopeful that the Obama administration can try to reverse some of the abysmal Bush policies in the Middle East had been hoping that there would be a different kind of relationship with Iran, some sort of rapprochement. But now it's become a little bit complicated, because if things continue as they are, where peaceful demonstrators are being shot to death in the streets and college students are being beaten up and hauled off, hundreds of university professors are resigning in protest over the way people's human rights are being violated, it becomes a little bit more complicated for those of us in the progressive community in the United States to think about what kind of a relationship the United States could have with an Iran that emerges from this crisis of legitimacy if Ahmadinejad, in fact, stays in power. I think what's clear, though, is that in the meantime, the Obama administration could perhaps do a much better job of trying to get a new cadre of advisors for their Iran policy in place so that they can be prepared to respond effectively once there's more clarity in Iran.
William Kern is joining us now as well. He's publisher and editor and founder of WorldMeet.us, as we've been a guest on the show many times, and his website translates articles from throughout the world in almost every language on the globe into English for us to read about takes on world politics and on American life and politics through the eyes of the international press. And William, talk for just a few moments briefly about what you're seeing in the international press.
Well, just to get back to what you were talking about before, we're probably never going to know, you know, how many votes, if there was a fraud, how many votes were stolen, where were they were stolen from. But there's a pretty widespread belief, incredulity, if you will, that in areas that the opposition candidate, Mousavi, for example, his hometown, he lost by 67% to 33% or something like that. That's almost impossible to imagine. So there's a lot of questions about the legitimacy of the vote, but we're probably never going to know. So if you look at the Iranian press that's available right now, and, of course, we're looking on worldmeets.us for articles that show how people in other countries feel about the U.S., so how all of this impinges on the U.S. is what we're interested in. There's obviously a breach within the leadership. You've got newspapers, English-language newspapers in the Iranian press, some that are printing Ahmadinejad's line, which is that he won and that it's time to move on and it's time to make friends and so on and so forth. And then you've got opposition-friendly newspapers that are emphasizing there's been a challenge, it's being legally pursued, and everybody should behave themselves. So there's obviously a breach within the Iranian press, which means there's a breach within the Iranian leadership because there is no free press. So that being said, the narrative in the global press right now is, did Obama's speech help trigger this? was what Obama promised to bring to the table too much for the hardline leaders to bear? That's what a lot of the foreign newspapers are writing about right now. Some of the translations we have in the work will probably post later on and tomorrow are about.
And I wonder, Sheila Balahi, you've been following very closely the what's happening on Twitter and Facebook and on the web coming out of Iran.
Mm-hmm.
And talk about what we're not hearing about what's going on and what you've seen in the last couple of hours and the last few hours that we may not know about.
Well, what's been happening, Mark, is really fascinating because even though Facebook, Twitter, and mobile networks are down in Iran, internet is up and running, there are these intermediary websites that you telephone and email and various sources to kind of collate information from Europe, the United States, all around the world, and within Iran. And one thing I wanted to point out is, you know, we were talking with Philip earlier about what the U.S. policy towards Iran might be. One thing that's clear is protesters within Iran are really asking for international support from people around the world. So even if the American government has their own situation that they have to sort out, support from American people and NGOs and activist groups is something that these student protesters are really looking for. Now, in terms of the kind of information that's coming out, there's a mix of a lot of these websites will have one column, which is unverified reports, which are rumors that they haven't been able to substantiate, and then the other side are verifiable reports, and also a lot of images, a lot of video and cell phone pictures that they're taking of the demonstrations. What we're seeing, first of all, is that the protests are all throughout Iran. It's not just in Tehran.
Mm-hmm.
The crackdown on universities, for example, isn't just the Tehran universities. It's the universities in Shiraz, Isfahan, Babol. We're seeing that Iranian exile communities, regardless of their political positions, except for the very kind of right-wing royalists, are coming together in support, kind of a non-factionalist support of the people in Iran for the first time in 30 years, which is really incredible. People are exchanging information. They're offering support. People outside are sending signals to Iran. So, for example, they're doing robocalling in Iran, telling people through automated telephone messages that if they go to protest, they're going to be beaten up. And so people are kind of saying, you know, heads up, ignore these phone calls that you're getting. There's an exchange of information that's going on, which is really remarkable.
Now, it has been really remarkable kind of trying to follow this stuff as it goes on. And I think that it's amazing what this new world of communication has done to change the way we understand world politics when it happens in other nations. And are you still with us, Phyllis?
I am. I couldn't hear any of William's part, but I was able to hear Sheva's just now.
All right. Well, let me see if we can get that straight. I apologize for that. If that happens again, just yell out, and I'll try to translate.
Okay.
Sorry about the phone problem. You know, when we see the complexity of what's happening in Iran right now, and as what Sheva describes, and I've seen being described in different ways in other websites, that this is these massive demonstrations taking place. There have been reports and pictures even of people who have been killed, and I guess that is, I'm not sure if that's been verified at the moment or not.
One person. Yeah.
And so this could really change the dynamic. I mean, things do have a tendency to unfold very quickly in events when things like this happen. And I wonder what your study of Iran and how you interpret those events.
You know, again, I don't mean this to sound like I'm trying to avoid taking a position, but
no.
I think it's too early for those of us who are not there, and probably even for most people who are there, who only can see one part of what's going on, to really have a sense of whether this is going to lead to a dramatic change in the national political culture. Is this going to lead to a so-called color revolution, as Khamenei has expressed his fear of, or is this something that's going to be something closer to the student uprising of 1999 into 2000 that was a very powerful mobilization for human rights, led by the students, but that eventually ended. You know, it was a mobilization that had several months of empowerment, but then ended with certain consequences. Certain changes did emerge as a result, but did not have the kind of all-encompassing, regime-changing, if you will, kind of impact that I think some people expected. I think the same thing is happening here. Now, we've seen indications that the regime is taking this level of protest very seriously. Whatever we think about how significant it will be or not be, the fact that Ayatollah Khamenei, after his meeting with the leading opposition candidate, Mousavi, had to reverse his position and say, yes, there will be an investigation, which now opens up the possibility that they may not stick to their so far three-day-long claim that Ahmadinejad won by this enormous amount and that it's a settled question. It may reopen that. That's all possible. It's also possible that this will be something that flares and then the immediacy of it dies down, but what it will have left behind with a newly empowered level of civil society, we may not see the results of that for some time. I think it's very, very difficult. I mean, I appreciate what Shiva was saying about the need, the calls for support from some of the civil society mobilizations. I also realize how important it is that we recognize how dangerous it can be for people on the ground mm-hmm. to receive support, even from civil society, let alone put aside the U.S. government, but from anyone in this country. It can put people in great danger. It can have political impact beyond what they may even see at the immediate moment. So I think it's something that we have to just watch very carefully with a great deal of respect for the history that our government and our country has played there for so many decades.
And I wonder how you think, that Shiva, in the long run, before you go back to William Curran, how this plays out in the internal political life of Iran. I mean, if there clearly is anybody and everybody who I've spoken to comes back from Iran, talks about this kind of almost underground that has existed for years in the cities all through Iran.
Mm-hmm.
And given the power of the theocracy, given the power of their police, given that Ahmadinejad has a huge base of power in Iran and that ideology does, I mean, what do you think this unleashes, and does it have a permanency, and how is that, I know you're not prescient, but I mean, how do you think this plays itself out?
Yeah, anyone who tries to predict what's going to happen in Iran inevitably ends up with egg on their face.
I don't want you to have egg on your face, I just, you know.
But one thing that I will say with some degree of confidence is that this is a very, very unique moment in Iranian history. And here are some reasons why. First of all, there seems to be a diminution in the politics of fear, the power of fear, which plays such an important role in how things in Iran operate. Clearly, everyone affiliated with the Ahmadinejad regime, including the police, including the Ministry of Interior, told people to stay home or they would possibly be shot. And yesterday they were using plainclothes guards and, you know, riot police on motorbikes to beat people up, women, old people, you name it. And today, you should see the pictures. I mean, estimates are of a million people who came out despite, you know, the fear of potentially being shot to death. They still came out. This is something completely different. It makes it very different from past social movements that have been limited to particular social groups like students or newspaper editors or merchants in the bazaar. This is something that is much more widespread, and it's all across the country, and that's also something significant. Another thing that's different about this particular moment from other periods of Iranian history since the 1979 revolution is that we're seeing publicly the divisions within the leadership of the Islamic Republic exposed. We're seeing different ayatollahs coming on different sides, some people supporting, you know, the elections as having been legitimate, other ayatollahs issuing statements saying that the elections weren't legitimate. We're seeing Mousavi coming out and openly saying, I don't trust the Council of Guardians to vet my complaint legitimately because they've shown that they're not impartial in this election. We're seeing there's rumors that Afsanjani is even moving behind the scenes against the Supreme Leader himself. So we're seeing right now publicly vetted divisions within the leadership of the Islamic Republic, which is very, very key. And I think it deciding factor is going to be who ultimately ends up controlling the brute force within the government. Right now, the Revolutionary Guard are squarely in the Basij, are squarely behind Ahmadinejad. And many people see this in a way as a coup by the more militant factions of the Islamic Republic against other elements of the Islamic Republic. I think, but if the people continue to show that they are fearless and they're willing to go out and get beaten up and even shot, then even when the politics of fear diminishes in Iran, we may see different outcomes from anything we've seen before in the last 30 years.
William Curran, have you been able to hear this?
Yes, I'm listening with interest, Mark.
And did you just hear that, Phyllis?
I did.
Okay, good. Let me bring you back in then, because I want to make sure we all hear each other here. I'm curious, again, going from the work you've been doing in translating from the international press, and I know you're not translating from the Iranian press at the moment, correct?
Well, we do need Farsi translators.
I'm not hearing William now.
People out there interested in helping us pursue this project on behalf of the American people, I would ask you to contact me through worldmeets.us.
All right, so Phyllis is just saying she's not hearing you.
I'm not hearing him either, but...
And Shiva can't hear you either. William, you know what, I think, let us try to call you back and see if that works better, all right? We'll go back to the guests. We'll call you right back. Phyllis Bennis is Senior Fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. Shiva Balaghi is a member of the Editorial Committee at the Middle East Report and Vice President of the American Institute on Iranian Studies and author of the book Iran, Art, Society, and Revolution, and is now finishing a book on modern Iranian cultural history. 410-319-8888 is the number here. I think that what's really kind of fascinating here also is that everybody's kind of holding with bated breath, and you're kind of people trying to watch and wait, but it's the international response, especially among young Iranians and Iranians in exile in general to what's going on, that has been pretty amazing to watch. I mean, it is the in America, I guess both of you know, I mean, the Iranians, American Iranians voted in this election.
Yes, in large numbers.
In large numbers. And there's this kind of change of attitude, I think, in America about all of that, and whether or not President Obama makes a statement, what kind of statement he makes, his election alone has kind of, in some senses, unleashed this groundswell of interest.
I think there's something very important in the election of President Obama, partly in terms of it being a rejection of the 8 years of the Bush policy, but it's also part of a sense in this country about new possibilities in general, new approaches. There is a challenge to the Bush-era ideological framework that used the politics of fear that Shiva referred to in Iran that was so powerful and remains very powerful still in this country since 9/11. There's been a huge reliance by the Bush administration on fear to mobilize support for policies that would never have reached popular support before. When I was doing my book that just came out, Understanding the U.S.-Iran Crisis, a primer, I was looking partly at some of the history of the U.S. relationship with Iran, and what's so ironic and what I think is so important about the change that's possible with President Obama is that so much of it came out of ignorance, that after 1979, the U.S. has had no diplomatic presence in Iran. Of course, that doesn't mean they don't get information.
Right.
Spies through the media, through satellites, through whatever. But that's very different than having official contacts that are constantly going back and forth, bringing information and having some grounding in what people are thinking. There is, I think, a possibility, and what Shiva referred to earlier, I think, is very important about the need for the Bush administration to find different people to take in as advisors and representatives on their Iran policy, not to leave it in the hands of Dennis Ross. There are rumors just today that came out in Haaretz, the Israeli newspaper, that Dennis Ross may in fact be about to be relieved of his position as the State Department's chief go-to guy on Iran.
And I saw that. What do you think that means if that happens?
It's not so clear that it's going to happen, but it's interesting that it's being floated as a possibility. He's sort of, in my view, the last person you want in charge of Iran policy, because he starts from the vantage point of military force being always either in the foreground or the background.
That was in his latest book, right?
Diplomacy.
Yes.
So I think that's very needed. But I do think that what's optimistic has been a very sophisticated understanding so far by the Obama administration that they don't need to respond instantly and make a judgment instantly and condemn instantly and distance themselves instantly, that they're waiting to see how it plays out. And I think that's a very, very important shift.
I think it's important. Maybe this is what we get, Phyllis, when we have an academic as and a lawyer as president.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps.
You know, instead of a failed businessman, as we've had for the last 8 years.
With a lot of oil interest.
But, you know, I think within the State Department, the people who are very heavily disgruntled and really marginalized by the Bush administration are in positions of some authority within the Obama administration. And these are people who have long called for a shift in U.S.-Iran relations. Their shift, frankly, is what's happening in Iran in and of itself, and not always seeing U.S.-Iranian relations as derivative of U.S.-Israeli relations. That's an important shift that needs to be made regardless of what happens in the outcome of the Iran election.
The administration,
and that's said, why people like Dennis Ross, you know, just can't be put in charge of this kind of, you know, new quote-unquote policy, because they represent the old and tried and failed policies vis-a-vis Iran going back to the Clinton administration. So I think that's clear that that needs to be done. You know, and it's good that they're being cautious because, for example, you know, former President Khatami has been under house arrest for a couple of days since the elections. And they're starting a file on him, and one of the main complaints against him is that he has, quote-unquote, ties with the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So it's good for the Obama administration to be cautious in how they're approaching this current situation, I think. The two countries that have come out and have openly congratulated Ahmadinejad on his reelection are North Korea and the Republic of Armenia.
And, that's interesting.
Yeah, asking for, you know, further investigation and are being cautious.
William, I'll try one more time. If it doesn't work, we'll have to get you on another day and see if we can hear you this time.
Okay. I was just going to say, the administration's already said that talking to Iran is not a reward for good behavior. It's something that if we do it, it will be because it's in the interests of the United States. So that seems to be a rational way to go about this. I do think the issue of whether Obama has ameliorated the threat that the United States seemed to pose is really a key issue, and it's something that most people in the international press are focusing on when they write about this issue.
Now, I wonder that one of the comments that Fawaz Joe just made today was that and there's been a guest on the show many times, is that this election cost the mullah support of women and young people, and that is a threat to their regime. And I wonder how much of a threat you all think that really is to his regime, to this the regime in Iran. Shiva and Phyllis?
Phyllis, why don't you go first?
Well, I'll stick with my original position. I don't think we know yet.
Uh-huh.
I think that this kind of a challenge is very powerful. It's specific constituencies that have emerged. But I simply think it's too soon to tell whether this is going to represent a consolidation of an ongoing identifiable constituency that will emerge with leadership and voices for the future, or whether this is an emergence for the moment. I simply think that it's enticing to fantasize, but I don't think we have any basis yet to know.
Shiva?
Well, one thing that I would say, again, you know, completely accepting Phyllis's caveat that we can't know for sure what's going to happen, but we can kind of begin to distinguish differences. So the youth in Iran have been, ever since the student movements that happened in the early part of the Khatami presidency, before the Khatami presidency, the young people in Iran have been largely apathetic politically, and they've mostly been trying to vote for social freedom. And especially under the Ahmadinejad administration, they've really been trying to get back to having those basic kind of levels of social freedoms that they had in the Khatami years. So this is something completely different in the sense that you have people coming right out for a very overt political purpose. And some of the chants in the streets, I mean, they're openly chanting death to the dictator in the streets of Tehran. This is something completely new. And they're also, finally in the figure of Mousavi, and, you know, one can certainly talk about what he actually represents and, you know, what who Mousavi, the real person, is versus
right.
Mousavi, the kind of, you know, leader that people are fantasizing he may be. But, you know, the opposition in Iran for a long time had a figurehead, hasn't had a person around whom people can kind of gather. And this is a moment where Mousavi is emerging as some sort of alternative. And it's someone that people are kind of putting all of their wishes and their hopes into. And they are very kind of political aspirations that people are asking for. They're asking to, for their rights as citizens to be acknowledged within the framework of the Constitution of the Islamic Republic. And that's really important because they're relying on peaceful demonstrations. They're asking for their legal rights that they should be given. And bear in mind that most of these kids that we're seeing out on the streets weren't even born before 1979.
And that's an important piece of this. And it's interesting. Mousavi,
if I could add just one piece to what
she said, go ahead.
And I actually have to go to another interview. I think that this point about the demand for political rights is very important. But I also think that the question of the economy is fundamental in this election. And I think we have heard way too little about it.
Mm-hmm.
It's something we don't really know how it played out. But clearly, the fact of the youthful nature of the Iranian population means that joblessness is a huge challenge for the regime, whoever is in power. The dramatic drop in oil prices means that the available cash for any regime, whoever is in power, is a huge challenge. And the question, for example, the point that Shiva just raised, that Mousavi may well be emerging as the point at which the opposition will gather around, there's real questions about his position on the economy. There's been accusations, some supportive and some oppositional, that he is a great defender, a great supporter of privatization schemes as the way out of the current economic crisis. The question of whether in this moment that's something that Ahmadinejad might embrace as well, because he certainly has not made good on the populist promises that he made. So whoever ends up taking power, the economic challenge remains a huge one. And I think that if the equation is made that everybody who is demanding greater political freedom and more political rights within the Constitution of the Islamic Republic is also supporting greater involvement of the Iranian economy in the globalized global economy led by the U.S., looking for greater foreign investment, looking for greater privatization, that raises a whole series of political challenges that could seriously divide the opposition before it ever emerges as a unified opposition.
That is a critically important point, Phyllis. I wish we'd gotten that earlier, but at least we got you. We'll expand on that the next time.
I look forward to it. Thanks very much.
Thanks so much. Phyllis Bennis has been with us, senior fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. And Shiva, I wonder if we have about a minute and a half or less left. And I wish you gave a comment on what you thought Phyllis said and how that fits into your kind of analysis and what you see in your look at Iran.
Well, I think this is really important because some people have said that, you know, this election was about class issues, with Ahmadinejad being more populist versus Mousavi, whose support base is more elite, vying more for cultural issues. But if you look, the long time between conservatives and reformists in the Islamic Republic, the main differences are really on issues of the economy. And the reformists tend to want to have further global integration of the Iranian economy, better relations with multinational corporations. Ahmadinejad comes from the conservative group that wants more isolationist economic policy, more kind of government-owned control over the economy. But he's created inflation of over 20% and incredibly high unemployment, which for a country that still has the second largest oil reserves in the world, it's hard for the people to swallow that they have to have such economic degradation. For example, one of the slogans against him is, stop giving our money to Hezbollah in Lebanon, give our money to poor people in Tehran.
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Well, Shiva, I wish we had more time. It looks like we're out of time. Shiva Balaghi, thank you so much for being with us. It's a pleasure to have you on the air. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
And William Crane, I'm sorry our phones and didn't get you on as much, but we'll have you back. You know that.
Look forward to it, Mark.
Thank you. Of course, go to worldmeet.us to see more of what the world is thinking about us. We are going to take a very brief break, and when we return, we're going to meet school teachers from Baltimore City to talk about the school year and more. So stay with us. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ was formed in 1936 during the Great Depression. Over 70 years later, they're still here to help people during difficult times. More information is available at MECU.com. Don't go away. We'll be right back.